It feels like a nine. Feels like a nine.
Feels like a nine.
And welcome back to another episode of Exposing Ourselves. I'm Travis Ritchie, and this is episode 64. This is the show where we expose each other to new things. Matt, a big music fan, will assign me one of his favorite music artists to listen to each week, and I, a movie buff, will give him one of my favorite films, and we come together on this very podcast to discuss it all. And with me, as always, is my very good friend,
Matt Rundquist. Hey, Travis, how you doing? This week, I watched the movie classic Stand By Me, and you listened to folk rockers Mumford & Sons.
Yes, I certainly did. And, you know, it just occurred to me, like, with me, as always, is you. And I, of course, am with you, as always. We have never done an episode with a guest host.
A
guest co-host.
Yeah, we did.
Like,
we
it's
did,
just always been two of us.
Yeah, we did an episode with an expert once.
An expert. So we had a third.
But no co-host.
In our duo.
Yeah. Yeah,
no,
why are you thinking about replacing me? I am going on a vacation this summer, so there could be a couple of weeks of... we could get... Kevin. We could get Kevin to maybe co-host.
Which Kevin?
Kevin Novacek.
Oh, that might be fun. Yeah,
he's
Kevin,
got very similar like taste.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, he's got very similar taste to me, and he.
And I haven't seen Kevin in years. That would be a very interesting experience for me. It is interesting though. It's a unique format. Like, you do need to do some homework for the show, and so it's not like you can just jump on in and do an episode. So, but I've been listening to a lot of my own podcasts that I listen to, that I'm a fan of, and like, there are guest hosts all the time, and there's no big deal about it. So it just got me thinking that we've
never done this. I would say the big difference between them and us is that they have a production budget, so that might be where the guest hosts are coming from.
Yeah. Oh no, for sure. Like, I'm listening to Marketplace, and they've got like a bajillion dollars. They have merch.
They've got all that sweet NPR money, all that Biden cash. Yeah.
All that tote bag money.
Tote bag money.
So anyway, how are you, my friend? It's been a week.
I'm doing pretty well. The weather is holding here. We've had some aurora borealis the last night, and we're going to have more tonight. There's a major solar event going on right now. I don't know if you know anything about that. But yeah, the magnetosphere is lighting up like crazy here.
That's great.
Here
I'm surprised
town,
that I don't, because you're pretty far south.
We are pretty far south here, and it's pretty, you know, we have a lot of light pollution here, and some people were still seeing it around here. I will go ahead and confess that I didn't see anything that I suspected was northern lights, but a lot of people in the area have posted photos. Apparently, it's actually easier to see if you, like, take a photo with your phone. Astrophotography has gotten so good on the phones these days that you can pick stuff up on the phone that you can't necessarily see with the naked eye or particularly well. When I saw the northern lights in Alaska when I was younger, they do appear very ghostly a lot of the time. They're not necessarily like super bright like we think of them in movies or whatnot.
Sure.
So it doesn't surprise me at all that photography helps sort of pick that up and clarify it.
They can be. I've only seen them one time when I was a child, and it might have been during some sort of heavy solar activity. But I was living in Wausau, which is at about the 45th parallel, so halfway between the equator and the North Pole, which is also pretty far south even then for northern lights. But I saw them, and they were shooting all the way up into the sky. It wasn't just around the horizon towards the north. They were shooting way up into the sky, and I just remember thinking how beautiful they were, and I would love to see that again. So maybe a trip to Alaska for me someday.
Yeah, for sure.
Fun.
For sure.
Yeah.
All right. Other than that this week, more gardening, lots of weeding things and cleaning the house and spring cleaning sorts of things. Nothing news-wise, really, though. Just enjoying the beautiful spring weather. One of the things that I love about the Midwest is the seasons, the sort of cycle of life. And so everything is like ramping up right now.
It's the cycle of life.
Sure, a Muppet singing Elton John. That's great. I like that. Yeah. It's a...
And it moves us all. That's really great. I had an interesting week at work. We did the Mother's Day episode at the talk, and I got to play a stork.
Oh,
I'm
nice.
Not sure I got to play, but they did offer me the chance to dress up as the stork for the Mother's Day prize giveaway,
uh-huh.
And it was not a comfortable costume. I've done a few costumed characters mm-hmm. for the show so far, and this was probably the worst so far, but it's nice. It's nice in that I get to double dip as a paycheck, because technically when you're dressing up as a character, when you're on camera, you're considered an extra
mm-hmm.
or a background actor. And my job is as a stand-in, and those are two separate contracts. And so they have to basically pay me for the day rate for an extra, as well as my day rate for stand-in work. And it ends up just double dipping a little bit. It's not a huge paycheck or anything like that, but you know, kind of nice. And it's always fun to just be out on the show dancing around, being
sure,
making a fool of myself.
Yeah.
And
do you remember Left what? Shark?
So, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Oh, of course you remember Left Shark. And I was just
Left
thinking,
Shark was the biggest thing of 2016.
Yeah, it was a big deal. So you know, I was just thinking about that guy having a lot of fun in his costume, and that reminds me of you.
Yes, absolutely. Well, and did you know, I don't know if you remember this, but back when we were in college, or maybe shortly thereafter, I worked at Best Buy.
I do remember.
And I was like a computer guy, and I think I did two Thanksgivings in a row, like Black Fridays, mm-hmm. and that was about all I could handle. But then one year, they wanted someone to dress up like the Idea Box mascot. Remember the Idea Box?
Sure, I'll say yes.
Okay, the Best Buy Idea Box was their big thing. And so I got to dress up as the Idea Box on Black Friday, which was so great because I didn't have to be out there dealing with all the idiots, you know, demanding the biggest deals on memory for their computers or whatever. And I just got to have so much fun. I walked outside and I was like directing traffic in this big, you know, Mascot costume. And it was just a lot of fun. So
did you ever watch the Hulu documentary about mascots? Mm-mm. I think it was called Behind the Mask.
I'm familiar with it, but no.
Yeah, the Milwaukee Bucks mascot was one of the – so they had a high school mascot, a college mascot, an amateur – or a semi-pro sports mascot, and then a pro mascot. And the pro mascot was the Milwaukee Bucks mascot. And it was just really fun for me to watch, just because I used to go to basketball games and I really enjoyed getting to see the man behind the mask and getting to see sort of some of those stunts and everything. And then the fun part was I was at a game later where all four of the mascot people from the show appeared at a Bucks game. They all rappelled down from the ceiling, actually, including the eighth grader, high schooler, or whatever he was.
Oh, that's cool.
It was really neat. Yeah, it was a good time. So
that's neat. I would love to rappel down from some ceiling to a
from something high. Just basically stuff. Anything.
Yeah, from something high. Just I got my skydiving license before the pandemic, right?
I do know that. Yeah. I think I saw that on Facebook. Yeah.
I just got a bug in my butt to like go skydiving, and like I had done it when I was around 21 or 22 back in Wisconsin, and I just never stopped thinking about it. And so I decided to get my license in 2018, and it took me about a year because you have to do it 25, you have to jump 25 times, and each time costs money, less and less money as you go, but it still costs a couple $1,000s to do the whole thing. And so it took me about a year, but yeah, I got my license and then never went again.
Oh, but you still have your license, right?
I do, but if I went back to do it, I would have to do the first course again to kind of refresh. And then you do need to jump like every 60 days to stay current. And then the more you jump, that time window lengthens, I think. So when you're the most experienced, I think you can go up to 6 months maybe without a jump. But of course, it's hard to become.
One of my former coworkers, all of his vacations revolved around jumping and doing, like, you know, the formation jumping and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I could see doing that. It's just that I have so many interests. Like, that's an expensive hobby. And if it was my only hobby, I could definitely see doing it. But I also want to scuba dive, and I also want to, you know, bike ride, and I also want to do all these other things. So,
well, I'll tell you this, Travis. I do not want to jump out of a perfectly good plane. Orville and Wilbur.
To be honest, they weren't perfectly good.
Orville and Wilbur. Passable. Did not die just so that I could jump out of a perfectly good plane, you know?
Yep, nope. Their sacrifice, I'm not going to treat their sacrifice in vain like
yeah,
that. Yeah,
exactly.
Good. I get you. Well, how about we get into the meat of the episode and let's shake things up and do...
let's do the music first. No, music first. Let's do the music first.
Okay, let's do the music first.
All guys, right, well, we just had our first argument. Sons. Yeah.
Are we fighting?
Yeah.
No, tell me about Mumford & Sons.
Mumford & Sons is a British folk rock band. I will confess, their sound is very Americana to me, and I was stunned to find out that this was an English band.
It shocks me in this moment to learn that they're British.
Yeah. Well, and I told you last week.
And if I'm learning that because I didn't learn it because I didn't listen to you last week, I'm sorry. But or maybe I forgot. But in any case, just is surprising.
Yeah, in the mid-2000s, they ended up being part of sort of a movement in popular music, or at least in alternative popular music, towards that sort of folkier Americana sound, lots of mandolins and other, you know, unusual stringed instruments, a lot of vocal harmonies, and definitely some upbeat stuff, but nothing that's like hard-edged or anything like that. I like Mumford & Sons a lot, but I've never gotten super duper into them. So like I said to you last week, this is a little bit like the Black Keys for me, where it's something that I like, but I'm definitely using this week to explore a little deeper than I ever have before. So there's three members in the band now. There were originally four. And honestly, it's one of those things where once you're on a major label, you know, there's 15 people on the album and then, you know, and 10 on the stage when they tour. But there's people that are a core part of the band. And the core band are Marcus Mumford and two other guys who are not named Marcus Mumford. And they're not his sons. So... let's see. What? I don't think I have a whole lot more to say about this. My favorite song, I think, is Little Lion Man. It's a song we used to do in karaoke all the time because there's a big chorus that everybody can sing along with. And those are great karaoke songs, especially if you're not a super confident singer, because you can get the whole crowd to sing along with you. Mm-hmm. What do you got, Travis? What do you think?
Well, shoot, man. That I really liked this. There is a ton to like about this, and I will say that this. I wonder if I want to save that. Yeah. So what I will say is that the singer is great. The music is packed full of energy, which I really, really, really liked. This was a great hiking playlist, which is, you know, when I was outside walking or hiking, it was fun to play in, just, you know, while I'm moving. And, I really enjoyed the production. This was a lot of the music was almost cinematic. In its use of, I don't even know if it was the percussion, if it was the processing of the music or something, but it felt like it could have been a song in a movie. Like this the triumphant moment in a movie, and here's this kind of music that comes in. And
well, you know, and I think I mentioned to you last week as well that Marcus Mumford did the theme music for
Ted Lasso. I listen
and that
sometimes.
Very much. Has that sweep to it that people really like. And it's great because it's like 15 seconds long, right? That's how long modern title songs are. But you really get that perspective even just in that short time. So,
yeah, I think Ted Lasso is actually a little longer than that. But it's not a theme song that gets annoying, which is kind of fun. And so here's the thing that was strange about this album is I think my rating of it went down with the repeated listen,
mm-hmm.
rather than the other way that usually happens is as I get familiar with something, I tend to think higher of it, right? Think better of it. And I'm trying to think of why that might be in this case. So I listened to it my first time through. Was actually almost two times through. So I finished listening to it on my hike, and instead of switching over to podcast like I normally do so I can kind of digest the music, mm-hmm. I started it playing right away. I just wanted to listen to it all over again. Not because I was like desperate to listen to it all over again. I just wanted to hear it again. And then I played it again today, and I think that there was a lot of a similar problem with the band. Was it the Black Keys that you were talking about where we really liked them, but it was that band where if you have one song on a playlist, it's great, but then too many songs on the playlist. Yeah,
you're thinking of St. Paul and the Broken Bones.
Yeah, right. So I wonder if that might be what this is suffering from, where it was just maybe too much energy for too long or something. I also thought there was a lot of, even in the same song, there was a lot of sameness. Mm. Like, there's differentiation between the songs, which I really liked. But in each song, in each individual song, I felt like there was too narrow of a theme, too narrow of a musical theme or something, you know?
Yeah, and I would say that, like, that's maybe one of the reasons I like Little Lion Man is that it's got, you know, some quieter parts and some sort of, like, evenness, and then the chorus is, like, big and bold, whereas you're right, a lot of them are kind of the samey across the song. Kind of the samey. That's English. I just Englished.
Yeah, across the song. Different from the other songs, like this playlist in particular is a well-put-together playlist, and there is variety within the playlist, but it's almost like superficial variety, right? Because the vibe and the feel is pretty consistent throughout their music, in my experience, just with this playlist. And so I just wonder if there was... I feel like that might be my main issue, and I don't want to dwell on that too much because it's still really good, and I really enjoyed listening to these guys. I think their talent is phenomenal, and their musicality and the orchestration of the music and the singing is all really, really good. I just wonder what it is that got me feeling less enthusiastic about it the more I listen to it.
Interesting. You know? Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? I kind of agree with that. And maybe it's the reason that I've never picked this up on a more consistent basis. I like Mumford & Sons. One of the issues is that, like the Black Keys, they're very, very big. This is a band that tours arenas and sells out arenas. And you know, there's this part of me that is just the indie kid from the 90s who inherently is suspicious of things that are super duper popular, right? I've tried to overcome that. I've tried to be a better person who doesn't just go, oh, it's popular, therefore it's bad, right? I don't do that anymore. Love me some Taylor Swift, et cetera, et cetera. But there is just part of me that is skeptical of bands like the Black Keys or 21 Pilots or a Mumford & Sons that are out there selling out arenas. I'm always just like, how good could it really be if this many people like it? Which is ridiculous, right? I know it is. But yeah. It still goes on in my brain.
It's not totally ridiculous because there are a number of instances where the most popular thing is popular because the lowest common denominator is into it, mm-hmm. right? And then there are other very popular things that are popular because they're good mm-hmm. and just inescapably good. I get that. You're not wrong, but yeah. I do the same thing where I will, if something is super popular, I'll just assume it can't be good. That's just from experience.
Right. And Mumford & Sons is good, right?
It's good.
It's upbeat. Sometimes there's some really beautiful melodies that are going on. Sometimes they're kind of generic, you know, a little bit, right? They're, this is how Marcus Mumford sings a song, right? And that sounds like Marcus Mumford singing the song. But there are some really clever melodies. There's, you know, like I said, there are some songs that do have some variation in them. But I would say these are sort of their most popular songs. And a lot of these can be very, very at one level.
Yeah, there is, strangely enough, one song you didn't include in this playlist. And that I was like, because this band sounded familiar to me. And so I sought out their, you know, like I do, I look at their most popular songs. And one of the ones that's most popular is a song called I Will Wait. And
oh, you didn't put this. Did I not put playlist. I Will Wait on that? Oops.
No, I was kind of surprised about that.
I do know and that so, song, yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm familiar with that one. And I listened to both the live version, which is their most popular play, their most popular track on YouTube Music, which is interesting. And then I listened to their studio track, which is less popular, but still something like 22 million views or listens. So it's doing okay. And then I went back and listened to it again today. So and got through it again. There was one other criticism I had for them, and it's fairly small. Because, again, I did like Marcus Mumford's singing, and I thought that he's really good at being loud and boisterous and bombastic with his voice and having it not be annoying, but also he can be quieter and a little bit more melodic, right?
Yeah, he's got good dynamic range, for sure.
Yes, dynamic. Is that a thing you use to describe singers in...
Sure. Yeah.
Is it real? Because it's in photography and videography, dynamic range is a real thing. So I'm just wondering.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's great. I like that. Okay. So, but there is one thing, and I found myself rewriting lyrics as I listened to them.
Okay.
Mostly the poetry in this album is pretty good, or in this playlist is pretty good. And we talk about that a lot, the writing of lyrics that are good and artistic, but not... not overly so, right?
Not fussy.
And so, but I did find myself a couple of times throughout this playlist rewriting lyrics. And I'll tell you one of them right off that sticks in my head. And it's a song called Guiding Light. And there's a line that says something like, oh, here it is. Because even when there is no star in sight, you'll always be my only guiding light. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, that doesn't make any sense at all. When there's no stars, you'll be my guiding light. Isn't it more impressive is if all the stars are shining so bright, you'll still be my only guiding light? Wouldn't that be more impressive?
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so.
You know, that you outshine the stars would be a much more flattering thing to say.
Exactly.
Than when there's nothing else, that's when I'll turn to you. So anyway, stuff like that I found, but teeny little things like that. And ultimately, this is still going to get a pretty good rating for me, although maybe not as good as it would have after the first listen.
Oh man, I'm really curious about this because you have a habit. I don't know if you know this, but you give a one particular rating far more than any other number, and I'm really curious if this is going to be that or not. So
it's not, Travis. It's going to be better than that. It's going to be better than that. But wait, before you ask me,
but you know what it is. You know,
I do know what it is. I sense, and I wonder. But maybe it will be. I don't know. Are we talking just for music or for everything?
Just for music.
Okay, good. Okay, so before you ask. Mm-hmm. I want to know more about what you particularly liked because you kind of glossed over your own, like.
No, I would agree quite a bit with you. I like the energy of this music. I like the production. I like the way the guitars are layered on one another. I think the lyrics are good and clever. A lot of them don't stick with me a ton, but when I do pay attention to the lyrics, I like them. And I like singing along with some of their big choruses. So there's a lot to like here for sure. And I just in general like kind of folky things. So
yeah, I did like all the different instruments and the it sounded a little like banjo, but you're saying it's mandolin and stuff.
Oh
like
no,
that.
there's mandolins, there's banjos, there's all kinds. There's all kinds of stuff going on.
Oh great,
there.
Okay, good. Yeah, I really liked hearing all the different stuff there. That was fun.
Yeah, they like filling out the. filling out the sonic palette for sure.
I like that too. Sonic Palette is a great name for a band name.
There you go. You can have that one. I don't need any band names right now. So
for my future band.
Yeah, for your future band. So, well, Travis, what do you rate this?
All right. So after my first walkthrough, after my first hike listening to this, I was like, you know what? I think this is a 9. It's a very good. Very good album, and I really enjoyed listening to it, and I loved the energy of it and all that stuff. And I was like, this is probably going to be a 9. But then after listening to it again, and really kind of becoming just ever so slightly annoyed at the sameness within the songs, within the individual songs, I think I'm going to lower it to an 8.
An 8. Very good. Very good.
7 is my biggest, is my most
7
rated number,
is
right?
Your most rated number by far. It's kind of it's kind of comical. It's just funny. There's like 5s and 7s. Like things you're not so hot on are 5s, and then things you do like but don't love are 7s. And those are by far your two most.
This is definitely better than most of those.
Okay. All right. Cool. Yeah. Well, for me, I think this is a 7, actually. This is kind of, I like it. I don't love it. There's a reason that I haven't really explored this a whole ton before. It's never something that I'm going to turn off when it's on, but it's not, it just doesn't quite do it for me in the way things that I truly love do.
Interesting. Is this a rare thing for me to rate a band higher than you do?
I was actually looking this up a couple of weeks ago. It's not common, but it has happened a few times. Yeah.
Got it. Interesting. All right, cool. Well, that's fun. Thanks for the Mumford & Sons.
Yeah, you got it. Well, Travis, tell me about Stand By Me.
Oh, Matt, I am going to tell you all about Stand By Me. Stand By Me is a movie that came out in 1986 from director Rob Reiner, who did all sorts of interesting things, including Misery, which was another Stephen King book, and he did The Princess Bride. But notably, Rob Reiner's production company is called Castle Rock Productions, which is named after the fictional town that Stephen King created. And this movie is based on a Stephen King short story called, or a novella called, The Body. And it's essentially about 4 preteen boys. They're all 12-ish, 10-ish, something around there, preteen. And they hear about this other kid who got hit by a train, and his body is out in the woods somewhere. So they decide they want to go see it and find it and maybe become famous for having found it, right? And so they all set out, and it's only a 20 or 30 mile walk, but they, you know, they're preteens, and that's a long way to go when you're young. And so they set out and they go on an adventure. Now, the thing that's amazing about this this movie is it stars a quartet of young boys who all went on to other bigger things. Not bigger, but continued to be movie stars, really. You've got Will Wheaton, who stars in it, River Phoenix, who ended up dying young, but he was he was on his way to big things. Corey Feldman, who was big, especially as paired with the other Corey Haim later. And then Jerry O'Connell, who we talked about before the show. I know Jerry very well. Jerry was going to call in and talk to us about this movie, but couldn't make it because we're recording this on Mother's Day weekend and he had other plans. But the 4 of them go off on this adventure, and it's kind of a coming of age story. It's a classic movie, man. It has stood the test of time to my mind, and I am going to go out on a limb and predict that you really liked this movie too. But to find out for sure, I'm going to ask you, Matt, what did you think of Stand By Me?
What did I think of Stand By Me? I quite liked this movie. It's funny because this is not necessarily the type of movie that we have done a lot in this little adventure of ours. this is a very quiet movie where not a lot happens. And historically, I've kind of been very up and down on movies like this. Like when I was a kid, I watched Remains of the Day, which is very famously a movie where almost nothing happens. It's two people that fall in love with each other and never tell each other, right? And I loved that movie. But there's a lot of movies where nothing happens and I'm like, oh my God, please plot, right? And so there's no guarantee that I was going to like this. And, you know, there are times when you're like, what did you like about this? And it's hard to say. I mean, you called it a coming of age tale and it's sort of that. And it sort of addresses like what it's like to grow up in a small town and how that limits your options and what it's like to grow up in an abusive household and the ways in which you cope with that and the importance of friendships when you're young and how scary it is to know that those are going to go away and trying to maybe hold on to those. These are all really abstract things, you know? And if somebody pitched me this movie, I got to admit, I'd be like, but what's the point, right? And the point is kind of the journey and the characters. Now, I know one of the reasons that you love this movie, we've talked about this before, you love a great child actor performance, and this is four great child actor performances.
Isn't it amazing that they managed to get four kids who are so different from each other, and each of them puts in a perfect, pitch-perfect performance that stands, I mean, 40 years later, here we are watching this movie, and they're still fantastic.
Well, you know, it's funny. I am a big Will Wheaton fan, and he talks a lot about this movie at various points in his writing. And one of the things that he points out that I think is really astute is that when they cast this movie, they cast kids who essentially were their characters.
Yeah.
Corey Feldman plays this like really ebullient, outgoing kid who maybe has some problems dealing with, you know, like the world. And that's kind of Corey Feldman. And River Phoenix is this just magnetic personality who draws people to him and definitely acts as the glue of this little group. And Will Wheaton is a geek, right? And at the time, Jerry O'Connell was a little younger than the other kids and he was a little fatter than the other kids. And he kind of gets bullied by them, but also is drawn to them. And they just cast kids who kind of embodied those characters and then set them loose. But it is an incredible achievement to get such subtle performances out of kids who were 10 to 12 years old.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes from director Rob Reiner coming himself from an actor's standpoint. So he was, when he was young, he was on All in the Family, right, as Meathead, right? Meathead? Meatloaf? Meathead. And so he knew how to talk to actors, which I think was a big thing, especially when dealing with kid actors, to get those performances. And, like, look, I have to respect that. One of the reasons I love good child performances so much is that I know that as good of an actor as I am now, which is pretty good, I think, you know, I'm not to toot my own horn too much, but I get a lot of response to my performances. And but I look back at myself acting as a younger man, college age and prior, and I am struck by how not great I was. I was fine. I was good, but really not great. And so to get a great performance out of a kid like this, I think is really extraordinary. And to have four of them.
Yeah.
Plus a young Kiefer Sutherland.
You know, wow, does Kiefer Sutherland play such a dirtbag in this?
Right?
And so well.
Like, even almost worse than... I mean, he's a Stephen King villain, which, you know, Ace Merrill shows up in a couple of different Stephen King stories, and he is a bad guy. And then John Cusack, a young John Cusack, like right when he was starting to hit his stride, shows up as Gordy, Will Wheaton's character's big brother, and he is such a perfect big brother.
Yeah, like, you know what's funny about that is in the movie, we're sort of, before we're introduced to John Cusack, one of the characters observes that Gordy looks like his brother. And, you know, and then John Cusack shows up and I'm like, Will Wheaton doesn't look like John Cusack. And then there's a framed shot of the two of them. And I'm like, oh my God, he does. They do really bear a little bit of a familial resemblance. I was super impressed because, of course, like, I would never, you know, nowadays be like, oh yeah, John Cusack and Will Wheaton look nothing like each other. But then you look at like their facial structure and everything and you're like, how is this possible? That these guys got cast at this age, you know?
Yeah, it's really neat. And then you do have a couple of older... so we have Richard Dreyfuss as the older Gordy.
Richard Dreyfuss like without missing... a mustache is just not okay. I mean, really? It's like... I like without him with a mustache. Yeah.
I don't think he had a mustache in a lot of the stuff that I've seen him in.
No. Maybe. I don't know. He just looks baby-faced.
I think of him in Jaws, and I don't think he had a mustache in there, right?
Yeah, no. He had those tiny glasses and Jaws, didn't he?
Every time I think of Richard Dreyfuss, I think about the there's a Saturday Night Live sketch where they have famous actors who, you know, so-and-so auditioning for Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And they had Richard Dreyfuss auditioning for C-3PO. And he's doing his thing and he's like, and he's got the helmet on. And he's like, I was in Jaws. I don't need this. He just gets frustrated. Anyway, I feel like I'm missing one other cameo from a famous older actor. Am I?
I don't know.
Well,
I'm sorry.
I don't know if it matters. I'll take a peek at it. But man. I think when you ask about the theme of this movie, by the way, I think it's growing up, right? And I think the one of the things that exemplifies that is that when they're all talking, all the four boys are around a campfire in their first night camping out on their trip, and they're talking about if you could only have one food for the rest of your life, what would it be? And Jerry O'Connell's character goes, oh, that's easy, Pez, cherry-flavored Pez, no question. And it's like, I think that is a pure child's perspective, right?
Yeah.
And by the end of the movie, all four boys have a much more grown-up perspective of the world.
Yeah.
And I think that also you mentioned it's a movie where nothing much happens, and I think that's very easy for us to say looking back as 40-somethings, but imagine you're an 11 or 12-year-old kid going on this journey. Such journeys felt really big.
Yeah, you know? And it's funny because one of the categories on whatever streaming service I was looking at this, one of the categories is adventure, right? Hmm. Which you think, it's not an adventure. They walk down a railroad track and they get to a dead body. But it is an adventure for them. You know, they're lying to their parents and going off and you know, it is an adventure. And so, yeah, I think that's a really good point, that from the perspective of the viewer, not a lot is happening, but from the perspective of the characters, this is a really pivotal event in their lives, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just such a fan of this movie, and I think that it's kind of incredible that so much of it stands up, even like the special effects regarding the train dodge and stuff like that, where they had to make it look good, or the pie eating contest, stuff like that. It's like so much fun, and all that could have easily felt so dated, but most of it doesn't.
Yeah, and that might be a function of this is part of the 80s trend towards 50s nostalgia. Right. This is like the boomer trend of, you know, American Graffiti and Grease and all the, you know, late 70s, early 80s nostalgia for 20 years earlier. And this, you know, this is set in 1959 and it's just part and parcel of that. But because of that, you know, structure, it ends up feeling a little bit timeless. Right. Because it was already set in the past when it was shot.
That's interesting. That's a really good point. And I think the other side of it is probably practical effects are almost always better if you do them well you know, if you're than if they are CGI. They could have put, like, nowadays all those leeches would probably be CGI leeches, and all the and they'd look fake, and you know, the train dodge would be all blue screen and nobody would be actually scared, and they weren't actually dodging a train. It was all like, you know, the train was way far away, and you can tell that they used a really long lens in the in the front-on shot where they're running from the train.
Yeah.
They use a really long lens to compress the space between them. But even that moment, man, the fear in those kids' faces as they're screaming for their lives, knowing that they're going to get creamed by this train and running from it, it was just really great. Really great stuff.
Yeah.
So...
yeah, really good.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. It made about $50 million on a something like a $7.5 million budget. And one interesting thing that I think is kind of an unanswered question is that the town in the story, it takes place in Castle Rock, Maine, which is Stephen King's fictional town that has become famous because he made it up. It's Maine, which is his state. Right, it makes sense. But for some reason, they changed this to Castle Rock, Oregon.
Yeah.
And there is only one, like, other town named, and it's because Castle Rock takes is situated a certain distance from Portland. And so I wonder if, like, because there's a Portland, Maine, and a Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
So maybe it was someone got confused, like some sort of
no. I think it was a deliberate choice. I'm not really sure. Maybe they just felt like the terrain that they had access to seemed more Oregon-y, you know.
I feel like it looks pretty the same, although they did shoot it in Oregon, so it's possible that there was some agreement from the local state permit thing that it had to be set in Oregon in the story too, which they were like, yeah, sure, okay, no big deal.
Yeah,
but
you've got a Portland, I just thought that so was fine.
Yeah, I just thought that was such a weird little thing. Like, why make it different than it did otherwise? Yeah, what did you think of? I just there's so much that I want to talk to you about the whole chopper thing. Like, the only dog in the movie is Chopper, the junkyard dog. And we, I mean, growing up, we all tried to teach our dogs to sick balls after this movie, and it didn't really work.
No, it doesn't really work. Yeah, no, but it's funny, right? Like, the movie is a series of vignettes set along the rail line, right? And yeah, that one works really well, especially how the dog ends up being kind of a, you know, kind of a pussycat, right?
Yeah. I mean, he's a he'll bite you, but he's like a golden retriever, right? Or something like that.
Yeah.
And, I did love, like, the nerd in me loves all of the discussions that they have, like who's going to win in a fight, Mighty Mouse or Superman? And the response is, you idiot. Mighty Mouse is a cartoon. Superman's a real guy. I don't know. I just remember, I think maybe one of the things that makes this movie so good is its ability to bring you back to your childhood. Mm-hmm. And I also wonder, for you and me, our childhoods are not a whole lot different than the childhoods of these four boys.
Yeah.
But I wonder about kids nowadays not having this kind of, like, go out on an adventure.
Yeah. I mean, childhood. Certainly we didn't have the freedom to leave the house for 48 hours, but we did for 4 or 6 or 8 hours, you know?
Sure. And I mean, if I had lied to my parents and said I was going over to your house, and they might not have called your parents to double check, and, you know, I don't know, maybe, but I probably could have gotten away for 2 days if I needed
really?
To.
Really? You think so?
Yeah,
oh,
think
not,
yeah.
Not my
well,
house.
I was also I was the youngest boy. So by the time I came along, my mom was pretty much sure I wasn't going to get myself killed. Lot of freedom.
But I would agree with you that our childhoods in the 80s were probably a lot more similar to this than a childhood now is. Certainly, you know, when my daughter was growing up in the late 2000s and early 2010s, you never would have had any kind of thing like this going on for sure.
Hmm. So. Interesting. You got anything to add?
You know, I don't, right? Like, I don't have a lot to say about this. It's well acted, it's well written, it's well paced, and not, like, yeah, not like a ton happens, but it's all good and it works together as a movie, and it even has like a nice climax and denouement and everything. And so, you know, what is there to say? This is a really good movie.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Well, what would you like to rate it?
This is going to be a 9 for me. It's not quite a 10. There are times when maybe it just dragged a little bit, and I think if I watched this 3 or 4 more times, it might eventually reach 10, but I don't know that I'm motivated to do that. So I think it's probably going to, it's going to be a 9 for me.
Interesting. Yeah, I will say that in my estimation, and I think in most people's estimation, this is an absolute modern classic. I say modern even though it's 40 years old, but it was a classic pretty shortly after it came out. I think even 10 years later, people were still thinking about this movie. And how many movies do we get these days that are like that, right? I think it has to achieve something very spectacular. I think... Oh, go ahead.
Well, I'm just curious. Like, from the early 80s, I don't feel like there are a ton of movies from that time period that really achieve that status, right? You know, E.T. maybe. But, like, when you think about what a rich, fertile ground the 1970s were for movies that are considered total and complete classics, 1980 to 1986 or so is kind of dry.
Oh, I completely disagree with
what,
you.
What do you got? What do you got?
So are you actually restricting us?
Let's
to
go back.
Certain genres.
I want to hear what your rating is first, and then we'll.
All right, continue. I'm going to settle on a 9 as well. Okay. Not because there's anything wrong with this movie. It is close to perfection, and I've probably watched it 5 times, or maybe 6, I don't know, and it never gets worse for me. I don't know why I'm not giving it a 10. Honestly, I just
right?
Don't
it just
think
feels
it
like
quite,
a 9 movie to me.
It
just
feels like a 9.
Yeah.
Feels like a 9.
Yeah.
Feels like a 9. Anyways. All right, so 9, okay. 9 is gonna be my rating.
So let me guess. Hold on. Are you going to say The Abyss?
The Abyss was 1989, but I will say, I mean, if you're allowing
me
sci-fi, because
sure,
the 80s are the perfect sci-fi. I mean, so not only do we get the Indiana Jones trilogy.
83? Is that Indiana Jones?
81 or 82.
The first
Indiana Jones was like 19, yeah, Raiders of the Lost Ark, I think, was like 1980, I think.
No,
I'm sorry. 80 was
81.
Empire Strikes Back.
Raiders is 81, yeah.
Raiders is 81. We've got Back to the Future in 85.
85.
We've got RoboCop, Predator.
Wait, when
Terminator.
Is RoboCop? When was
RoboCop?
RoboCop
was like 87 from Paul Verhoeven.
I said 86. That was like 80 to 86. Yeah, so like 80 to 85.
Okay. Well, it was shot in 1986. But Back to the Future was 85. Terminator was 84. Aliens was 86.
Okay. Interesting.
You know,
so that's interesting. Because no, you're no, I would agree with you, right? There are those sort of instant classics, and they're all sort of pretty much genre films, right?
Yes. But, so that is where the 80s really shone, which is part of why it's such a warm place in my heart. Like the 80s as a decade is
the best. That's
movies,
interesting. And I guess I'm really contrasting that to the 1970s sort of auteur films, right? The Apocalypse Nows and the Raging Bulls and the Godfather trilogy and that sort of thing, right? Very, very different kind of film, sort of a prestige-y thing. And I don't discount genre films at all. And you're absolutely right that a 100 great franchises were launched between 1980 and 85, but this type of movie that's like not a genre film and is very much a like creator driven, performance driven type of thing. Okay. I feel like it was a much drier period.
I'll give you that, and I'll give some thought to that, and maybe we can talk about some of that a little bit. But I'm not disagreeing with you.
All right, cool. Well, what do you have for me next week, Travis?
Oh, for next week, something that's kind of related, actually. So, well, not really. So,
related to what?
It's so tangentially related to everything we've just been discussing. But there is a so the director J.J. Abrams has a real love for the 80s as well. So he loved this kind of Spielbergian kind of way of making movies, right? And the idea of kids experiencing things that are new and doing things a different way. He made a movie called Super 8 that is basically about kids discovering a monster in their town. And it's not actually one of my favorite movies, so I'm not going to assign you that. But the movie that made Super 8 possible is a movie called Cloverfield. Have you ever seen it?
I have not.
Yeah, I didn't think so. Cloverfield is going to be a callback to some of the things we've experienced already on this show. It is a found footage monster movie. So kind of the way Chronicle was a found footage movie, Cloverfield does that as if Godzilla hits New York, but you're only seeing it through this found footage format. And I really liked it. At the time, I found it very inventive, and I didn't realize at the time that it was kind of, like, the trailer for it is a video footage of a party going on, and then the power goes out, and there's, like, an earthquake, and then the kids run out, and you see the head of the Statue of Liberty bouncing down the street. And that's the trailer. And I was like, oh, this looks so much fun. And then it turns out the whole movie is found footage. So, yeah. And it's basically, I just summed it up. It's like a Godzilla type creature comes to town. And
all right.
I'm interested to see what you think of it. I'm also interested to revisit it. I've seen it a few times, but it's been a while.
All right. Cool. Awesome. Look forward to it.
What do you got for me?
Well, have you ever heard of Emily Scott Robinson?
No, but my grandmother's maiden name was Robinson. So maybe
nice.
They're related.
Yeah, it's possible. Emily Scott Robinson is a folk and country Americana type singer who came to my attention a couple of years ago when she did an EP, which is a do you know what an EP is? It's like
it stands for something press
extended
right?
play.
Extended play,
which is funny because it's shorter than a long play. It's 6 songs, and it's songs that were written for a performance of Macbeth that there was a theater company out in Colorado that was doing a production of Macbeth, and they wanted to have some songs performed on stage during Macbeth, and they got Emily Scott Robinson to write and perform them. And she released this EP, and I really like it. It's pretty short. It's only 20-some minutes long. I added a couple of songs of hers that I like that are not on that album. I think it's called Built on Bones or something. It's got kind of a cool name. Oh, yeah, it's called Built on Bones. And I really like it. It's got an ethereal quality that I really, really dig. And then some of her other stuff is like pretty country, and I'm not super into that, but some of her stuff is very folky, and I really like that. And she's got a beautiful, clear voice, and I think you might really like this. This one's only 8 tracks, 30 minutes. You'll probably bang right through it, but I'm curious to hear what you think of Emily Scott Robinson.
That's very interesting. I'm interested to hear it. Normally I say excited, I think, but I like your description of the ethereal nature, so that vibes with me. Hey, Matt, if people wanted to reach out to us and give suggestions of their own for us to watch or listen to, how would they do such a thing?
Well, they could email us at exposingourselvespodcast@gmail.com, or they can go to our Facebook page by searching Exposing Ourselves.
Nice. And if you would do us a favor, friend and listener, if you're listening this far, do me a solid and scroll right down the show page to the bottom wherever you're listening to it and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or whatever app you're listening to listen to this podcast. Just give us a rating and write a couple sentences as a review just to say if you like listening to us. And that would help us out immensely. I appreciate it.
Hey, Travis. Just
personally, yeah.
Thank you for exposing yourself to me.
Matthew.
Yeah.
Thank you for exposing yourself to me.
Well, you're very welcome. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. This is Matt. Just wanted to cut in and let you know that next week there's not going to be an episode. The episode about Cloverfield and Emily Scott Robinson will go up on June 2nd. Thanks for listening.